Let us pray. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. This sermon is the result in part of our Bible study this morning in the Little Missouri Synod Lutheran Church that Sarah and I attend. We have a Bible study group every Monday night in which the church prepares the Word. And so I hope that I'm in some real way faithful to not only this little church and the church which met this morning, but the church through the centuries. There was a young man who lived in a suburb of Chicago. His parents had given him many opportunities, and he had taken advantage of them. And finally, they let him go away one day with money in his pocket and with their blessing to make his way in the big city at the University of Chicago. For a time, things went well. He followed the old pattern. Then gradually a change took place. He began to sleep late in the morning. He quit attending classes. Gaming absorbed more and more of his time with bridge and poker. Things went from bad to worse. He did not graduate with his class. He found himself out of money, working behind a steam table in a restaurant for 45 cents an hour. Then one day, as he was taking off his drenched garments, thick and dripping with perspiration, he came to himself. Why hide? Why not go home? Why not face the music? Why not ask for another chance? He wrote his family. He told them that he would be coming home late Sunday night. He wrote that he had squandered his life, misused what they and God had given him, that he wanted to start over again, but that he did not want to embarrass them. And so if they really wanted him to come, they were to leave a light on that they had left for years in the front of the house. Now, this was, of course, before the time when it was fashionable to be a failure. So his friend took him home, and as they neared the street, He said to his friend, I don't think I can look. So if you'd look for me and see if that light is on. As they came down the street, he said, is there a light? His friend said, there is no light. The house is ablaze with light. His sister had been a success. She was a member of Phi Beta Kappa, many honors, many scholarships. Had not cost the family anything really, because she'd had all the scholarships. She had come home to help in the store. And when he entered in this blaze of light and was received with crying, she wondered out loud how her parents could do this to her. And her parents said to her, you know, we would not do without you. We could not do without you. Everything we have is yours. How can we not celebrate your brother who is lost, is found? Where we once saw nothing but death, There is now life and hope. I want to talk to you about several episodes in the parable of the prodigal, I'm not quite sure what to call it in this day and age, whether it's the prodigal person or the prodigal daughter, as one person suggested, or the prodigal son. And I'm very serious. I want to talk to you about the welcome first. His heart went out to him. While he was still a long way off, his father saw him, and his heart went out to him. He ran to meet him, flung his arms around him, and kissed him, and said to his servants, "Quick, fetch a robe, my best one, and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and shoes on his feet. Bring the fatted calf and kill it, and let us have a feast to celebrate the day. For this son of mine was dead and has come back to life. He was lost and is found." We have a situation then of a person who's dead, lost, engaged in reckless living or riotous living or loose living, depending on what translation you use. We have a person who was steeped in what he describes to himself, I think, as sin. That's one side. Then we have on the other side a heart that's going out, running to meet him, flinging his arms around him and kissing him, giving him a robe and ring and shoes and killing the fatted calf, and celebration was in order. We have on the one side then sin. I think we have an admission of sin. We'll get to that later. And on the other side we have grace. We have a graciousness, an acceptance of life, bone and flesh and blood, with great joy. Now, what is being said here? I hesitate to say this to the Lutherans. What is being said here? What is being said is that one is justified by grace. By grace. Not by faith. By grace. By God's act. God runs out to meet you. And he's running out to meet you right now. God runs out to meet you in Jesus Christ. I sometimes wonder if our hearts, as well as our bodies, run out to meet each other. I was talking to Dale today, who's known because of this newfangled psychological stuff that he's dealing with. But in a sense, and I've been involved with that a little, just a little, enough to know I don't know anything. But we were talking about the way in which in his groups people feel that somebody, somewhere, somehow is running out to meet them. And in that running out, being run after, they find a kind of freedom and a wholeness. And they come to themselves. And that's the second episode I want to talk about. Because in a sense, there would have been no running out to meet anybody if somebody hadn't come to himself. There was a man who had two sons. And the younger said to his father, Father, give me my share of the property. So he divided his estate between them. A few days later, the younger son turned the whole of his share into cash and left home for a distant country, where he squandered it in reckless living. He had spent it all when a severe famine fell upon the country, and he began to feel the pinch. That's the first line. He began to feel the pinch. He was broke. And he had to go to work. So was I. So he went and attached himself to one of the local landowners, who sent him on to his farm to mind the pigs. And he would have been glad to fill his belly with the pods that the pigs were eating. And no one gave him anything. No one gave him anything. He was broke. He was hungry. He was starving. And no one gave him anything. Then he came to his senses. And he said, how many of my father's paid servants have more food than they can eat? And here I am starving to death. I will set off and go to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against God and against you. I am no longer fit to be called your son. Treat me as one of your paid servants. So he set out for his father's house. He began to feel the pinch. No one gave him anything. He came to his senses. He came to himself. I will say I have sinned against God and against you. I am no longer fit to be called your son. Now the son was a failure. I think it's very clear. And moreover, the son was starving. Now under such conditions, one might do several things. One might be too proud to beg, so he would starve. Very few of us would do that, but some of us are that way. Some of us, rather than ask anybody for anything, would die. But that's not in the story. That's a little side benefit. One might take stock and calculate. Now, how am I going to get some food and security? Like the unjust doors, which was an alternate reading for tonight, which I didn't take. I couldn't handle that one. That's a tough one. But the unjust steward found out a way, you know, take care of himself. He calculated. Now one might say, not that I will say I have sinned, but that I do sin. I am a sinner. Now, I don't know what the writer of this text meant or means or what is meant, really, by having in every translation I read, at least, I will say that I'm a sinner. Now, there's quite a bit of difference between saying you're a sinner and believing it. Because we repeat that creed, don't we? Or we repeat that we're sinners every time we turn around up at this village. And so far as I can see, that it's a good thing to do. He says, I will say I have sinned against God and my Father. Did he say it or did he know it? Now there are a lot of conflicts that occur in the daily life around here. And I guess I'm most familiar with them on the volleyball court. No, there are different abilities, and when you get somebody somebody who has a little difficulty with the game, with some of the others who think they don't have any difficulties with the game, it causes a few little conflicts if you get them in the same game. And you can see the scheming around down there to get them out of the game or to get another game going in which the pros, quote unquote, can play together. There are different ways of playing, really. At least it seems to me. Now, I come from a place where the fellows were playing, you know, with Olympic rules, and so I think I know the way it should be played. There are different rules, you know, as to whether you can put your hand over. Last I heard, you could block over, but you can't spike over. Well, you know, there are even different views of every ball as to whether it goes out in those lines. Man, those lines are so sloppy. There's quite a little conflict going on down there. And it brings out the real competitiveness in some of us and in me. Now, I play to win. And sometimes I say I'd rather play a good game and play it well than win, but I'm not sure Sarah thinks that I believe it. I think she thinks I put winning on a pretty high priority list. Now, the other night, there was a big debate between me and another guy as to whether or not he was over the net. Now, he got there, and he outwitted me, you see, a little. I think he outwitted me, actually, but I said he was over the net. And I got quite heated, and in the course of the conversation, I said, well, I believe in self-judgment. Well, I had a little hard time with Vespers that night. And I don't know what happened in Vespers that night. But Sarah came back and she said, well, he said, this theological junk doesn't make any difference when you get down to life. I guess he knew that I was supposed to know a little theology. At least I'd read a little, even read a little Luther, quite a bit of Luther, as a matter of fact, and it didn't seem to him that it helped any. Well, I was sitting there, and I didn't know what to do. I was very unhappy, and I don't know whether I came to myself, but I went up and talked to him. And he was feeling the same way, it turned out. And the upshot of it is, and things don't always work out this way nicely, because you never know what kind of a father you've got, what kind of a literal father you've got. You may know what kind of a heavenly father you got, but you got a real problem in knowing what kind of a literal father or a literal neighbor you had. So things don't always work out nicely. We had a little love feast and got together for breakfast the next morning. And, you know, the story seems to have a good ending. I came to myself and I said, I was just hot and bothered. I was angry, and I got carried away. And I don't think I said forgive me with my mouth. How do we come to ourselves? How do we come to ourselves? Did the prodigal son, really come to himself? Did he feel his guilt, or was he clever? Was he clever? How could he feel his guilt? How could he feel his guilt? He was alone. No one gave him anything. How can you feel your guilt if you don't know that your father is gracious? Did he have a memory somehow that his father was gracious? Was there something in his experience that told him that mercy and judgment are together, or mercy takes precedence over judgment? How could he feel his guilt? How could he really admit to himself out there that he was a sinner? Now, this is kind of like the chicken and egg, I think. It's one of the eternal mysteries, I think, because somehow it seems to me that the only way you can admit what you are is to know you're accepted, whatever you are. And if you haven't had any experience of being accepted, whatever you are, it seems to me it's pretty hard to admit the truth of what you are. It's very hard in this world of ours, and very hard with the kind of parents most of us have had, to admit that you're a failure. It's getting to be the custom, but it's still very difficult. One of those mysteries, I think. And I suppose for us we can declare that what happened 2,000 years ago, if we can believe it and if we can feel it, says to us that God was in Christ, declaring once and for all that we are acceptable in spite of what we are. That our guilt really has been taken by God upon himself in Jesus Christ. Now the other question here about coming to yourself is that the prodigal son was a failure, and he was hungry, he was broke. Most of us are not hungry. Most of us are not broke. Most of us, in some sense, are not really failures. At least, I'm sure those cars parked down, and, you know, that we're not broke. We're not without resources. In the world's eyes, we're successes. So, do we have in this story, then, a real kind of story of our lives? Well, sometimes I believe the deeper you get in a person's life, no matter how much a success he is, the more you find that he thinks he's a failure. But I wouldn't want to generalize. How do we then somehow be brought to our knees? How are we brought to our knees? How do we get open so that a gracious God and Jesus Christ can speak to us? Now, I guess I've got a strain of Calvinism in me which says the law does this. That's in Luther too, of course, but it seems to me sometimes it's a pretty simple law. We've been trying to work on the law for the environment this past 2 weeks. And I asserted this, and I'm not sure that Paul would agree, but whether or not he agrees or not, it gives you the direction. We said everybody ought to cut his budget 20 to 50%. That's the law. You're a sinner if you don't. Maybe not a serious sinner. I mean, there may be some worse sins. But God's creation is being desecrated, and the minerals that take centuries and millions of years to develop are being used up, and the future mankind is being ignored by us. We ought to cut our budgets, especially where metals are involved and where gasoline is burned by the huge monsters that we drive. And Paul says we ought to spend it for services, because we invest it just be used by somebody else for monsters. So there are little problems of what the law is, but there is a law that in a sense convicts all of us of not loving our brother. And when you get to the Indians and the black people, of which we're going to hear a lot the next week, and which I'm going to be on at this is a plug, I guess, in the afternoons after Paul gets over about Thursday. If you get to the black people and the Indians, it's clear the sins are, this is back to fourth generation at least, and what we have done there is enough to make all of us guilty. So, I guess there are ways in which, even if we're successful in the eyes of the world, we can feel the need for the gracious God. The third thing I want to talk about is the elder brother. I guess this is now a favorite subject for sermon. What I call the small self, elf the self, or self the elf, or something like that. The elder daughter, the elder brother, was angry, and refused to go in. Now this parable, you may recall, was one of three, which was an answer to the grumbling of the Jewish saints, the Pharisees, and the men of wisdom, the doctors of law, who complained that Jesus welcomed sinners and ate with them. And so this parable is the parable that goes along with the lost sheep and the 10 pieces of silver, which is really addressing how one looks at the hero. I mean, in the sense, the prodigal son is the hero of the story. He's the one who comes to himself. I don't know whether he's the hero, but it's hard to make the elder brother the hero. There is joy among the angels over one sinner who repents. But the elder brother is justified by being good and different. And he thinks he receives the goods of life like air because he is good. He really doesn't want the sinners to have air. I don't think he wants the sinners to have air. I don't think he wants the sinners to have his God either. Now, we are all elder brothers. I'm an elder brother. Envy what others have, and especially sometimes those who in their freedom find a kind of joy and recklessness and peace that we don't have. Now, we can come to ourselves and admit that we have sinned against God and persons if we know a merciful, accepting God in Jesus Christ. Now, this is where the parable seems to end. But this is only half the story. What happened to the hero after the reception? What happened to the hero? He repented. I'll assume that he really meant it. He really repented. He came home. He was received. A merciful God took him into his arms, ran out to meet him. Did he recognize the feelings of his elder brother? Did he go to him and try to make it up to him in some way? Did he recognize what he'd done? Did he accept the envy and hostility and anger of his brothers and sisters? In other words, what we were talking about this morning, did our hero not only find it possible to live with his guilt, but in freedom to live with his life? Freedom from the condemnation of the law brings freedom for obedience to the law. Christian is a free man, slave of no one. But he's also a bound man, slave of Christ. Now that is not very simple, however, since the whole creation groaneth and travaileth, waiting for its salvation. There's no easy way for our hero to live in freedom. The same God who delivers us from our guilt must be called upon to deliver us from meaning or for meaning today and tomorrow. The same God who delivers us from the past guarantees to deliver meaning for the future. We may be alive. We may be without power. We may not know what to do. We may be in conflict with our spouses or our friends. We may not get along on the volleyball court. We may be pushed around by others in the lines around here. We may do the pushing and not be able to get over it, and then feel bad all the meal. But the God who reconciles us in Jesus Christ also guarantees that every whisper and every step, every breath and every laugh, every pain and every joy, will be in some mysterious way treasured in his kingdom. God's grace frees us to be, as one person put it today, to leave home, one kind of home, to accept ourselves, to accept the God who is running out to meet us. But God's grace also sanctifies whatever we in our freedom do in some strange way if we do it in obedience. I think the person who probably brought me closer to Christ, or was really the vehicle was a Japanese Christian called Toyohiko Kagawa. Kind of a fool for Christ, really. And he went down in the slums and lived in a 6x6. We recently bought a tent 7x7. And trying to get my feet in that tent 7x7 makes me realize what this place 6x6 must have been. And he took in a ne'er-do-well who had trachoma, and he contracted trachoma. He tried to build health services, and he built cooperatives. I remember when he came to our cooperative at the University of Chicago, where we were trying to feed people during the Depression for a pittance so they could go to school. Anyway, he wrote a poem that really kind of, I really think it signifies the God who sanctifies. And what faith in that kind of a God does for one in the midst of his travail. I have no one to make a garment for me, nor yet a garment to be made. My clothes are soiled and torn and tattered. On the streets, the people stare at me each time I leave the slums. But those who clothe themselves in borrowed garb are like a crow wearing peacock's feathers. Fools, as for myself, bare legs, short shirt, sweatband on brow, I gird me up to move the world. And when I wash my one poor garment stiff with filth, naked I lie in the mud to weep and pray. Strip thus of all that thou hast given me, Lord, I would give again my all to thee. Most of us have less than we want. Many of us are wandering and wondering. I am wandering and wondering a good deal of the time. And when I'm wandering and wondering, I try to listen to this fool for Christ. Stripped, or in short supply, of all that thou hast given me, of friends, of life partner, of reputation, of status, of power, of health, of position, of wealth, of skill. I see this fool for Christ, dealing in the mud, weeping and praying. And I hear this fool for Christ saying to me, Lord, in some small way, help me to give my all to thee.